Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
So today, I think a lot of people think concerns about immigration are a recent phenomenon. I mean, definitely in the United States, which is where we live and can talk about from experience, but maybe in other nations too, but definitely in the U.S., right? People don't think of this as a thing that's been around for a long time.
Yeah, I think there's prevailing thought that, they're colonists came and that was the big immigration thing. And then there was this big gap and now we're all arguing and worried about it again.
Yeah, within like the last, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. So in a way, it definitely is a new concern for people because for about 150 years after the nation was founded, there weren't really any immigration laws, right? If you could get here, you got to live here. That was basically how it worked.
Yep.
The 19th century. So back in the late 1700s, the country didn't really seem to care about immigration. But to look at another way, it is not a new concern at all because the United States started passing immigration laws and a lot of them were targeted at immigrants from specific countries in the 1860s. So this is both a really new idea given the whole history of the United States as a nation. And a really old one, given that it's been around for more than 150 years. So that whole division between like legal and illegal immigration is simultaneously new and old. And today's story is part of that centuries-long history, because for parts of the 20th century, the United States and Mexico had agreements in place that were allowing and even encouraging Mexican nationals to enter the United States to do agricultural work and other labor, mostly in the American Southwest. And one specific program called the Bracero Program was launched during World War II to address a labor shortage as American men were needed for the war effort. But an unintended side effect of this program that was about legally coming to the United States to work was this huge increase in the number of people who were crossing the border from Mexico illegally. And these illegal entries reached a point that the government implemented another program, which I'm going to make it clear, this is not an acceptable word to use today, but it is literally what the program was named. It was called Operation Wetback, to deport Mexican nationals in huge groups. So the intertwined stories of these two government programs is what we are going to talk about today.
And before 1910, there was simply not a lot of regulation of the United States border with Mexico. People pretty much crossed back and forth as they pleased. And as agricultural industries started to really grow in the Southwest, these industries started to really rely on this readily available and seasonal workforce that was coming in from Mexico. In the 1920s, this also became true of other industries in the American West and Southwest as well, including railroads and mining. But today we're talking mostly about agriculture.
So using Mexican nationals as a source of labor basically came with some benefits. Agricultural work in a lot of places is highly seasonal, and for the most part, migrant workers who were U.S. citizens were traveling as families. They would spend the year moving from place to place as a family, for the most part spending a lot more time looking for work than actually working. And when there was work, it was usually work that the whole family did, including the children, in an effort to try to make enough money to last them for the rest of the year. So that's not an ideal situation in a lot of ways.
Mexican workers, on the other hand, tended to be young men traveling in groups with other young men. A group of young men was overall a lot more efficient than a family with children. And on the more exploitive side of things, many were willing to accept lower wages than what was considered standard among Americans. Because of a limited proficiency with the English language, Mexican nationals were often unaware of laws or standards that could protect them in their work. And as a result, there were a lot of growers and farmers in the American West and Southwest who were willing to overlook the issue of whether a person had come into the United States legally or not in order to get cheap, easy-to-exploit labor.
By the early 1920s, though, an increasing number of people were starting to think of this basically open border and the way it affected the labor pool as a big problem. Large farms were driving down their own costs by employing large numbers of Mexican migrant workers at a really low rate of pay, and small farms considered themselves to be at a big financial disadvantage as a result. Labor organizations started tacitly excluding Mexican workers when they formed unions, and also started using their political clout to lobby the government for more enforcement along the border and to put a stop to immigration from Mexico. In 1924, the United States formally established the Border Patrol as part of the Labor Appropriation Act.
As the U.S. government started taking steps to secure the Mexican border and curtail illegal immigration in the 1920s, local communities and states began taking steps to regulate their own Mexican population as well. As we've discussed in our podcasts on Mendez versus Westminster and Macario Garcia, much of the Southwest and West approached its Hispanic and Latino population in much the same way most of the rest of the nation did its black population, through segregation, which was reinforced either through laws or through social customs. In places with large Mexican and Mexican-American populations, discrimination was widespread and socially accepted by much of the Anglo community.
During the Great Depression, which lasted roughly a decade beginning in 1929, and the Dust Bowl, which was a devastating period of drought and dust storms that struck much of the Southwest and Great Plains during the same time, life was pretty hard for pretty much everybody in the region, but it was especially hard for people of Mexican descent. The Anglo community was increasingly hostile toward Mexican migrants, viewing them as unnecessary competition for incredibly scarce jobs. The industries that had been relying so heavily on Mexican labor for so long increasingly tried to exclude Mexicans from their workforce during the Great Depression.
Prior to the Great Depression, the United States and Mexico had been working together to find ways to send Mexican nationals who were in the U.S. illegally back to Mexico. During the Great Depression, those efforts increased. President Herbert Hoover ordered the Department of Labor to work out a deportation program. The Mexican government tried to identify its citizens who were in the United States and, in many cases, paid for their return to Mexico. Also, due to the Great Depression, Mexico was facing its own labor shortage, so part of the reason it paid to repatriate its citizens was to try to fill that labor shortage.
Between 1929 and 1935, about 85,000 Mexicans voluntarily returned to Mexico, and another 400,000 were deported or repatriated, depending on how you want to look at it. Most of the ones who tried to return to the United States during the Great Depression were turned away at the border, which at this point was a lot more secure than it had been earlier than the 1920s.
However, things shifted dramatically once again during World War II. The draft applied to all men residing in the United States, whether they were citizens or not. Roughly 750,000 Hispanic men saw some sort of active service in the war.
And with so many men serving in the war, the job market changed dramatically in the United States. Many men who had held agricultural jobs went to serve in the war. And then other men and women moved out of agriculture and into higher paying manufacturing jobs that were either opened up as part of the war effort or because the people who had been doing those jobs joined the armed forces. The war also disrupted trade with Europe, which cut off the United States' sources of many goods and meant that basically America had to make them for ourselves.
The overall effect of all this on the labor pool for agricultural work was, as you might suspect, enormous. And it led the U.S. to work out a program specifically to recruit Mexican workers. And we're going to talk more about that after we pause and thank one of the sponsors that keeps our show going.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian. Someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day. Seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/Papertarian. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
To return to the Bracero program, this huge shift in the workforce during World War II had immediate and detrimental effects on agriculture. Soon after the war began, the Southwest's cotton and vegetable growers were petitioning Congress to hire temporary workers to help them fill a labor shortfall that basically meant they couldn't harvest what they needed to harvest.
The key here was that this workforce would be temporary. In the words of a report from President Harry S. Truman's Commission on Migratory Labor later in 1951, quote, "The demand for migratory labor is thus essentially twofold, to be ready to go to work when needed, to be gone when not needed." So the United States, leaning on Franklin D. Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, started trying to work out a bilateral agreement with Mexico that would allow Mexican nationals to enter the United States to work and then return home when they were done.
At first, Mexico was reluctant to do this for a number of reasons. Mexican citizens who had previously immigrated to do exactly these types of work had faced discrimination and exploitive treatment in the United States. Many had been forced out of their jobs and stranded during the Great Depression. So basically, Mexico remembered all of that and just didn't have a lot of confidence that its citizens would be treated fairly if they went back to the United States to work. So Mexico insisted that any agreement spell out protections for its citizens, one that would protect Mexican laborers while in the United States and would protect Mexico's own industries from suffering due to a lack of workers.
Mexico did, however, see some potential benefits to allowing its citizens to work in the United States. It was hoped that anyone who entered the program would return home with money that would be injected into the Mexican economy. Running parallel with that was the idea that Mexico's workers would learn new techniques relating to agriculture and then bring those new techniques back to Mexico.
The result of this negotiation between Mexico and the United States was the Bracero program, which was launched in 1942 by executive order and then formalized by a bilateral agreement on April 26, 1943. It would later be amended by Public Law 78 in 1951. The basic terms of the Bracero program would be that this would be non-military work. It was not acceptable to recruit Mexican nationals to work in agriculture and then put them into the military service. Mexican nationals would be protected from discrimination. Employers would pay transportation and living expenses as well as a fair wage. Workers would get medical and sanitary services at no cost to them. People enrolling in the Bracero program would sign a Spanish language contract and be paid a fair wage that would not be less than what was standard for Anglo workers in the area. And workers under the age of 14 were not allowed.
There were also protections if there was a shortage of work, guaranteeing a subsistence level pay if someone contracted with a Mexican national but turned out not to have work for them to do. A percentage of the Bracero's pay was also to be saved and returned to them once they returned to Mexico.
The criteria for the workers themselves were that they had to be young, healthy men who had agricultural experience but did not own land of their own. They also needed to have a letter from local authorities saying that their labor wasn't needed where they actually lived, and that was to try to diminish the impact on Mexico's own labor force. Applicants would go to collection points in Mexico, be fingerprinted, be sprayed down with DDT, and then be taken to the United States.
In spite of concerns that Mexican nationals would take jobs away from Americans, at first this seemed like a mutually beneficial agreement. The United States would get the farm labor it needed, and Mexico would get new, modernized farming techniques, an injection of cash into its economy, and jobs for citizens who needed them.
However, things took a turn for the worse pretty much immediately. Most of the work to be done was known as stoop labor. This was cultivation work that was done using a short-handled hoe stooped over rows into the fields. This was grueling. And, like, it could have been done with a long-handled hoe instead of a short-handled hoe that required you to literally stoop over, but for some reason people thought a long-handled hoe was damaging to the crops. Today, the short-handled hoe is regarded as an occupational hazard, and in many states it is banned as unsafe.
There were also way more interested Mexican nationals than there were jobs. And soon, officials processing applications were accepting bribes to move people ahead of the line. Recruitment efforts became prone to corruption.
People who didn't meet these qualifications, for one reason or another, also started using the constant traffic back and forth across the border to make the crossing themselves illegally. And as was the case before, there were still plenty of growers who were willing to hire these people for almost no money. Unscrupulous growers also figured out that a lot of the Mexican nationals who were actually part of the Bracero program didn't have a lot of proficiency in English and weren't aware of the pay and protections they were legally entitled to under the terms of this program. This definitely was not universal. In various parts of the United States, braceros organized themselves and went on strike to protest low wages and poor treatment that were specifically outlawed in the Bracero program's terms.
Many growers flouted the rules of the program and hired people who had crossed illegally to get around having to worry about all of this. Mexico eventually refused to send workers to the entire state of Texas because of flagrant hiring of unauthorized workers, as well as other abuses.
So soon, illegal border crossings were rampant, and the employment of people who had entered illegally was widespread. Wages started to drop for basically everyone because there were so many low-wage workers who had become part of the economy in the Southwest. That minimum standard housing and medical care that was supposed to be part of this program also didn't materialize, and a lot of people who actually were part of it wound up tightly packed together in barracks on canvas cots, where respiratory diseases and other illnesses spread like wildfire.
Over the 22-year life of this program, 4.5 million Mexican nationals legally came to the United States to work, some of them returning to the U.S. repeatedly under new contracts. But far more entered illegally, outside the bounds of the program. There was actually a 6,000% increase in illegal immigration between 1944 and 1954.
Support for the program, which had never been universal, started to wane after World War II was over, and Americans who had survived the war started to return home and to try to reclaim their old jobs. The official wartime program ended on December 31st of 1947, although the program continued to be extended for peacetime purposes for quite a while after that.
And eventually, Mexico, fed up with what it saw as the United States' refusal to enforce the terms of their bilateral agreement, stopped participating by just declining to send any more workers through official channels. According to the Texas State Historical Association's Handbook of Texas, the U.S. retaliated against Mexico's non-participation in 1951 by allowing thousands of people to enter the U.S. illegally, arresting them, and then, rather than deporting them, turning them over to the Texas Employment Commission to be put to work.
By the 1960s, the Bracero program was officially on the way out. Labor organizations had become a lot more influential in policy and had started advocating very vocally for jobs in the United States to be filled by Americans and not by Mexicans. At the same time, increasing mechanization in the agriculture industry meant that a lot of the physical labor that had required this huge labor pool was disappearing. The need for physical labor became a lot smaller.
The Bracero program needed to be reauthorized periodically, and there were increasingly contentious debates whenever it came up for renewal. Its reauthorizations in 1961 and 1963, in particular, were extremely hotly debated. There was a lot of pressure to end the program after a bus accident killed 32 migrant workers in 1963. The Bracero program eventually expired the following year in 1964.
With the abolition of the program, one of the things that proponents had often said about it turned out apparently to be true. A lot of people who were in favor of the program insisted that American workers did not want to do this work, which is why it needed to be open to Mexican nationals. After the abolition of the program, there were about 519,000 unemployed people in California, which should have been plenty to cover the 70,000 people who were needed to do stoop labor in the agricultural industry. But the nature of the work and the wages that were offered meant that a lot of these jobs went unfilled and tons of fruits and vegetables rotted in the fields. So there was a lot of argument that this should have been like a gradual phase out rather than just an abrupt abolition.
As we said at the top of the show, running parallel to all of this was a mass deportation program focused on Mexican nationals called the horrible name Operation Wetback. And we're going to talk about that after we pause once again and take a break and hear from one of our fantastic sponsors.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian. Someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/Papertarian. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
To get back to Operation Wetback, as an example of how the United States' thinking on immigration shifted in the 1930s and 40s, President Franklin D. Roosevelt combined two other government agencies to form the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1933. This agency was originally part of the Department of Labor. In 1940, that changed. The INS and the Border Patrol that fell under it moved from the Department of Labor to the Department of Justice. So with that, the INS and the Border Patrol were no longer about work. They were about law enforcement.
And as we said, Operation Wetback was a mass deportation effort that came along after the INS moved to the Department of Justice. It's often portrayed as a swift, decisive effort to deport people who had entered the U.S. illegally. But it was really part of a decades-long effort that ran, as we said, parallel to most of the Bracero program. In the 1940s, for example, special Mexican deportation parties were established to try to apprehend and deport Mexican migrant workers. In 1945, there was an attempt to reinforce targeted portions of the border with chain-link fencing. In the 1940s and 1950s, some Border Patrol agents ran an unsanctioned, quote, little barbershop, basically clippers that they carried with them to cut the hair of repeat immigration offenders, sometimes in intentionally humiliating ways.
In terms of the more above-board efforts to control immigration, a lot of them really were cross-national. The United States wanted to keep illegal immigration from driving down wages and causing housing and social issues within its own borders. And Mexico wanted to have enough workers to meet its own labor needs and also protect its citizens from exploitation and discrimination while they were in the United States.
In 1951, a report on Mexican migrant workers in the U.S. pinned all sorts of social and economic ills on illegal immigration and characterized the situation as an invasion. Soon, the U.S. was diverting more and more of the Border Patrol and INS to the Mexican border, more than doubling the number of agents that were stationed there. And between 1943 and 1953, there were a lot more people apprehended in illegal border crossings. The number rose from 11,715 in 1943 to 885,587 in 1953, with Mexicans making up more and more of those apprehended.
At the same time, though, the United States didn't actually increase the Immigration and Naturalization Services budget. So even though there were more agents on the Mexican border, there were fewer agents overall, with the force's numbers dropping a third between 1942 and 1951.
When Dwight D. Eisenhower took office as president in 1953, it's estimated that 3 million Mexican nationals in the U.S. had entered the country illegally. But previous efforts to deport them had increasingly stalled out because so many farms and ranches were dependent on this illicit labor pool. In the words of Walt Edwards, who served in the Border Patrol from 1951 to 1964, quote, "When we caught illegal aliens on farms and ranches, the farmer or rancher would often call and complain. And depending on how politically connected they were, there would be political intervention."
Yeah, that political intervention was basically getting their workers out of jail and turning away from the fact that they were not supposed to be in the United States. In 1954, Eisenhower appointed General Joseph Swing, also known as Jumpin' Joe, as the commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Swing started transferring immigration officials who had spent a long time in the Southwest to other parts of the country with the hope of breaking all those social and political ties to all the local farmers, ranchers, and political bigwigs that was leading the service to not actually enforce immigration.
Then, on June 9th, 1954, Swing announced the commencement of Operation Wetback. One arm of the operation was meant to physically apprehend and remove people who had illegally immigrated into the United States. The other was meant to publicize this effort, to make sure people who weren't in the country legally knew about it and see the deportation force as a threat. A lot of this publicity deliberately exaggerated the size and aggressiveness of the deportation force in the hope of scaring people into leaving the country voluntarily.
On June 17, 1954, immigration officials started the actual sweeps to apprehend and deport people who had illegally immigrated. About 750 immigration agents moved north through California and Arizona. They started in those two states because the entrenched resistance to deportation was lower there, so they were hoping to kind of get a good foothold before moving on to places where it was more contentious. They had a goal of apprehending 1,000 people who had entered the country illegally every day. By the end of July, 50,000 people had been arrested in California and Arizona, and an estimated 488,000 had fled the United States on their own. And as Tracy had said, it started in California and Arizona, but from there it moved into Utah, Nevada, Texas, and Idaho. And immigration officials put the people that were apprehended in these sweeps onto trains and buses bound for Mexico, far enough south that they simply couldn't turn around and re-enter the United States. Two ships were also used for this purpose. The Emancipation and the Mercurio carried people from Port Isabel in Texas about 500 miles to Veracruz in Mexico.
At the time, the INS claimed that it deported 1.3 million people during Operation Wetback, but those numbers have not really held up to historical scrutiny. It was definitely lower than that, and it might have been as low as 300,000.
These efforts actually disrupted some of the agriculture industry in the states that were targeted by deporting their workforces. Like we said, a lot of the agriculture industry in the Southwest and West had become highly dependent on this illegal labor. The government tried to reassure people that they could get new labor through the Bracero program, which was still in effect at this point.
In addition to the immediate impact that it had on the agriculture industry, there were other problems with Project Wetback as well, aside from its name, which I'm going to say again is a racial slur we would not normally say on this show. Everyone of Mexican descent was suspect, whether they had entered the country illegally or not. And a lot of the lawful residents, some of them American citizens, were deported in error. Families were broken up when some members were caught up in a sweep and others weren't. Children were left without anyone to look after them when their parents were arrested and deported. Mexican-American communities were disrupted when their populations were basically decimated, and then that would basically leave whoever was left without the basic life amenities that they needed.
And the problems did not end north of the border. People who were dropped off in Mexico were often left in completely unfamiliar territory where they had no friends or family, without any food, without water, and with no money. 88 people from just one roundup died of heat stroke after being left in remote territory without food or water. Conditions on the Emancipation and the Mercurio were also appalling, incredibly overcrowded and dismal. On one voyage, a riot broke out, and the use of ships was eventually stopped after 7 people drowned during one voyage.
Apart from all of that, that 10% of their pay that was supposed to be withheld for legitimate participants of the Bracero program and then returned to them when they returned to Mexico, a lot of people never saw it. A settlement was in the works in 2008 to restore this pay to the former workers and their descendants. But as of 2013, there were still marches and protests going on to have this money restored because it had never actually happened. So that is the basics of like this long, kind of convoluted, intertwined effort to both recruit and deport Mexican nationals in the United States. I know for sure that there are folks in the world whose mindset is, well, they're illegally in here. It serves them right. I personally think that if you are traveling hundreds of miles away from your family to do physically grueling stoop labor for little money, like, imagine what your life is like to lead you to that decision, right?
Yeah.
Like, what other option might you have?
Yeah.
Have empathy, that's what I'm saying.
Do you have some listener mail that is empathetic or otherwise?
Oh, it is. It's so empathetic. It's from Richard, and it is about our recent podcast on Desmond T. Doss. And Richard says, "Dear Tracy and Holly, I want to drop you a note and tell you how much I enjoy listening to the podcast. I go for a walk every morning before I go to work, and I listen to podcasts as I walk. I'm pretty sure that friends and family are tired of me telling them things I have learned by listening to you. Your recent podcast on Desmond T. Doss really struck a chord with me. I didn't learn about him in history class, but I was familiar with his story. When I was a boy, I loved to read. My favorite place was the public library in Longmont, Colorado. During the time I was going to school in Longmont, I read just about every book in the kids section of the library. I still remember being disappointed that I was only allowed to check out 3 books at a time. I also didn't understand why I couldn't check out books from the adult section on my kids' library card." I'm going to pause for a moment. This was exactly my experience as a child, so.
It was pretty close to mine, and I will say when I first read this email, when it first came in, my first thought was, Tracy is going to fall in love with this.
Yep.
I also had the problem of when I was in preschool, I had read all the books in the classroom and then there weren't anymore. And I was very frustrated by the situation.
As a comparison, my solution was to kind of sweet talk the librarian, and I got books on the down low.
I was too socially anxious to do this. In kindergarten, my teacher wanted me to go to the library by myself to get books to read because, like, I already could read, so I didn't really need the lessons about how to read.
Right.
And I would just cry because I couldn't handle the idea of going to the library by myself. Aww. And then asking a stranger to help me find a book. Anyway, I'm going to get back to the letter now, which is much more positive than the story that I just told. So Richard says, I would take my three books home and have them read in a day or two and then beg my mama to take me back to the library. I kept a flashlight handy for reading after I was supposed to be asleep. The Longmont Public Library was my access to knowledge. One of the books that I read that made a big impression on me was The Unlikeliest Hero by Bouton Herndon. It was a story of Desmond T. Doss. In 1999, I had the honor of listening to Desmond Doss speak to a group of young people. I had taken a group of young boys ages 10 to 14 to hear him. After his talk, my boys wanted to meet him. We waited for a chance to talk to him. Desmond stayed until everyone who wanted to meet him had a chance. He took the time to visit with each one of the boys personally after he talked. The boys loved him and were very impressed. They said to me, "We got to meet a real American hero. I am proud to have been able to meet this gentleman. His story made an impression on me when I was a boy, and when I met him, I was impressed by his humility. Even though everyone in the audience wanted to hear about his Medal of Honor, he was uncomfortable talking about his actions. He focused more on being prepared and being willing to help others. He stressed the importance of standing up for your convictions. I remember him talking about the poster that showed the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer and what an impression it made on him. Thank you for making more people aware of this humble American hero, Richard." Thank you so much, Richard. I don't have anything else to add because I interrupted your letter to add all of my commentary.
Yeah.
Support your local library. I can say that.
For sure.
So much of our work is tied directly to our local library. And I have such fond memories of my local library when I was a child and summer reading programs, and where we lived was kind of rural, so it took us a little while to get to the library, but all summer long, I basically looked forward to going to the library and getting as many books as possible. If you would like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're a history podcast at howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/MistinHistory, and we're on Twitter at MistinHistory. Our Tumblr is MistinHistory.tumblr.com. We're also on Pinterest at Pinterest.com/MistinHistory. Our Instagram is at MistinHistory also. If you would like to learn more about what we talked about today, you can come to our parent company's website, which is HowStuffWorks.com, and you will find all kinds of articles on all kinds of stuff. You can also come to our website, which is at MistinHistory.com, and you will find show notes and an archive of every podcast we have ever done and lots of other cool stuff. So you can do all that and a whole lot more at HowStuffWorks.com or MistinHistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.